I'd like to call the December 9th, 2013 meeting of the Tompkins County Public Safety Committee to order. Are there any changes to the agenda for the committee members? Seeing none, could I get a motion for the approval of the March 19th minutes? Jim? What's that?
I thought you said March 19th.
November 9th.
November. All in favor?
Aye.
We will dispense with the chair's report for the day. We do have several appointments. They should be in the back of your packet. Hopefully you've had time to review those. Could I get a motion to approve those, please? Pam? Second? Seconded by Peter. Any discussion on any of them? Okay. All in favor? It's unanimous. Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for attending this meeting. As promised, we plan to give you an overview of information that the Public Safety Committee primarily and the entire legislature had in making the decisions that we've made to date and the jail renovation project. Okay, thanks. Yep. It is going to be as comprehensive as can be, and primarily given by a panel. Most of the folks are right here on this side. We would ask that we hold any questions until the end. We're looking to have some time for a dialogue of back and forth, and this is scheduled to get over, as every meeting is, after 2 hours, which would be 5:30. However, that's not hard and fast. Of course, we're not going to stay here till 8 o'clock, but we want to have everyone leave here with as much information as possible. So, like I said, that will be at the end. I guess I'd like to start by introducing the folks that are up here. For those of you that don't know me, my name is Brian Robinson, and I'm the lucky person that gets to chair this committee for this year. Peter Stein, to my right, is the vice chair. Jim Dennis, right here. Leslyn McBean Claiborne will be here in 10 minutes. And that's not David McKenna. It's actually Pam McAsey that's on this committee. And there's Pam right there.
Oh, you mean here.
What's that?
You're talking about this isn't me?
No, you are you.
You're up not there. David.
Yeah, oh, you're you up there, yeah. Up
you
there
are you.
Well, that's interesting. Boy, I guess the year came early.
Next. We have our presenters for today. Like I said, I've introduced myself. Joe Mariana, the county administrator, right here. If you folks could just kind of raise your hand so they know who you are. Our district attorney, Gwen Wilkinson. Judge Rowley, we expect here in a little bit. Deb Dietrich, executive director of OAR. Pat Buchel, Director of Probation and Community Justice. Susie Cook is the chair of CJATI. And Ken Lansing is the sheriff. And I think I'll turn it over to you, Joe, if you want to get going.
Thanks, Brian. Just to kind of get things started, and we'll start at the end, and then we'll give you some perspective on this. But as you know, we're here talking about a plan to renovate the jail. The plan is intended to reduce our board outs in the jail by using an indoor recreational room that is very little used. to repurpose that room to allow 7 beds to be added, and to replace that indoor recreation space with a sheltered outdoor facility. So in terms of the project that we have been talking about now for the past year, this is basically the project that is on the table. Our goal today is to really provide a better sense of context of the decision that has led to this plan. I think when we look back and saw what had been presented in the course of this project, we realized it was a very small segment of a very long history of a commitment to alternatives to incarceration in this community that we really hadn't explained as a part of our decision-making process. So our goal today is to provide a better sense of context for that, some things that were really on our table or in our minds as we brought this to a decision. So if we're looking at context, we should begin with history. And I see a number of people in this room who can attest to the history of this county's rejection of big jail proposals. And there have been several big jail proposals, and those proposals have been consistently rejected by this county in favor of making meaningful investments in alternatives to incarceration. I see Tim Joseph here and Martha Robertson and Deb Dietrich and Pam McAsey. I'm sure there are many others who fought these battles that go back over a decade to, again, reject the idea of a big jail in favor of spending money wisely on alternatives to incarceration. A good case study of that is a 2002 jail study for a prop I brought. The culmination of that study that was done back in 2002, that effort was triggered by state pressure to expand our facility to add beds. This is kind of a recurring theme in the jail and prison system in the state. The state is often pressuring governments to add beds. That's what triggered this study. And when the experts came to the county to project what we should expect in the way of pressures on the existing facility, they projected literally linear growth. So as you look at their charts and read their analyses, they proposed at that time, and it wasn't that long ago, about 11 or 12 years ago, at that time they proposed adding 120 beds to our 75-bed facility. At that time, that project would have cost the county $19 million in brick and mortar. I don't know how much more it would have cost for additional staff, but $19 million in brick and mortar. And when we bring those dollars forward, that's about $25 million in today's dollars. That was the start of a series of studies. There were several subsequent studies that were done in the middle part of the decade, the latter part of the decade. And in every case, the county consistently rejected the brick and mortar solutions in favor of increasing our investment in alternatives to incarceration. Now, in accepting that, in basically freezing the size of our facility, we accepted a risk. We knew at that time that if additional beds weren't added, there was a risk of additional board outs if the state refused to grant an appropriate number of variances for us. So that was basically the risk that was assumed in taking that policy position. Well, I wanted to show you what the experts had projected in terms of the growth of our prison population, of our jail population. You can see the way it rose literally from about 90 up to about 145 over that period of time, about 20 years. And to accommodate that size of population, the experts had recommended a jail that had 195 beds in it to allow for flexibility and classification and so forth. In terms of what our actual experience has been so far, you can see that we have departed from that linear path, that our population has been relatively stable over that period of time. In fact, we have declined from a blip that occurred in the middle part of the decade. I will tell you that I read a report that was written by Tim Joseph when this was the analysis was prepared, saying that we should not accept linear growth assumptions for the prison population. I keep saying prison, I mean jail. And we didn't. And in fact, through the work that we've done here, we have been able to buck that trend. And again, this shows you the actual prison and jail populations that we've experienced over the past decade. So how has that occurred? How have we avoided that linear growth of jail population? Well, we've looked at several steps that run along the path of the criminal justice system, from arrest to bail to arraignment and so forth. And we wanted to share some of the statistics that relate to each of those.
Joe, hang on just a sec. You all set? All set? Okay.
So we've tried to pull data because we really believe that it's important to look objectively at our situation and make decisions based on that and to share that with all of those involved. So beginning with the process of arrest, when you look at the statistics, you will find that we are near the bottom of New York State counties in terms of arrest rates. If you look at the total arrest per 1,000 of population, so if you equalize by population, you can see that we rank 51st of 57 counties in New York State outside of New York City. And you get a sense in that chart of where we rank on that scale. You can see, again, many are significantly higher than us, and we are at the bottom 10% of all counties in New York State. I know that a concern has been how many of the arrests that occur here relate to drug offenses. So we took a look at misdemeanor drug arrests per 1,000 of population. So again, we standardize by population. We find that we're 45th out of 57 in the state. And even though we're not quite as close to the bottom as we're in the other category, if you look at us compared to many other counties, you can see how far below the norm we are. And then if you look at felony drug arrests per 1,000 of population, again, recognizing the concern about how many people are in jail because of drug-related charges, you find that we are literally at the bottom of the pack. We have the lowest felony drug arrest among upstate counties in New York State. So of the 57 counties, we rank 57th. If you look at drug arrests in counties outside of New York City and in New York State, drug charges represent about 15% of all arrests. Here in Tompkins County, drug arrests represent only about 6% of all arrests. So in terms of highest charge, only 111 of the 1,700, almost 1,800 arrests in the county were drug-related. Now, in terms of arraignment and bail, I'm going to turn this part of the presentation over to the District Attorney, Gwen Wilkinson, to talk about some of the parameters and considerations in the establishment of bail.
Sure. Thank you, Joe. Hi, everybody. Arraignment and bail and the setting of bail are two of the earliest phases of any criminal case, misdemeanor or felony. The issue of bail is governed by statute and the discretion of judges. The factors to be considered in the setting of bail are two, really. One is risk of flight and any factor that goes to risk of flight. And the second is a new one that was established by our legislature only this year, which allows judges in domestic violence cases to take into consideration dangerousness in deciding whether bail needs to be set. There are statutory rules about the ability of judges to set bail. A, felonies cannot have bail set. Anyone who has two prior felonies cannot have bail set. The court literally doesn't have the power to set the bail. For any defendant who does have bail set and who feels that their bail is excessive, they have recourse to something that's called, not surprisingly, an excessive bail review. That is available to every defendant, and it is conducted in a court different than the one that initially set the bail. So it would be a different judge considering the question of whether the bail was originally set at an appropriate level. As far as arraignment goes, arraignment is simply the designation for the portion of the case at which the defendant is made officially aware of the charges against him or her and has the ability with certain level cases to enter a plea for other cases. That opportunity comes later in the process. I think that about covers the high points. I'll be happy to take any questions on that you may have later.
And just to hit the second point that's on the slide, I think everybody here realizes that bail levels are really outside the purview of the county legislature. There's really not much we can do at this level with respect to influencing bail levels. It's all outside of our system. I wanted to spend just a minute or two to talk about kind of the next step in the process, which also makes us somewhat unique in terms of the quality of service that we provide, and that is that if an individual is arrested and is unable to afford their own attorney, We provide that attorney. Now, that's everybody does that. But in terms of the way it's done in this county, it is rapid and is with quality counsel. Many people don't know the difference between a public defender's office, which is common in many parts of New York State, and what we have, which is an assigned counsel program. Julia Hughes is here, who heads up that program for us. But it's what we do is an assigned counsel program. It's different than a public defender's office. And kind of the mental image of a public defender's office, unfortunately, is often right, where they are often harried. There's often a high caseload that they carry. It's a very difficult environment. Here, we assign an attorney to an individual when they are when they find themselves in custody and they are unable to afford counsel. We assign them private attorneys because we can distribute those cases pretty evenly between a large group of attorneys. It means that we have manageable caseload levels, and as you can understand, the quality of representation that we can provide to an individual depends a lot on the caseload level that's carried by an attorney. And I'm going to show you some statistics in just a second that will show you how good we are in terms of that metric. This county spends 20% more for defense than it does for prosecution. In many counties, that's an aspiration of a public defender's office or an assigned counsel program to have in the budget the same amount of money that's given to the prosecution. Here in Tompkins County, we spend 20% more for defense than we do for prosecution. I came from Onondaga County, so I took a look at their budget and found that there the DA receives 27% more funding than does their indigent defense program. That's probably the norm. In terms of benchmarks, how do we fare objectively? If you accept the metric, how much do we spend per arrest? We spend the sixth highest amount per arrest for indigent defense. And importantly, we have the third lowest caseload per attorney level in the state of New York. Just another graphic to show you how we stack up. We're the yellow line there. This is brand new data that's been provided by the Office of Indigent Legal Services. It shows how close each county is to ABA caseload standards, national ABA caseload standards. You can see that we're one of four that gets pretty close to what the absolute standard is. You can see how quickly the rest fall off and how far away from the caseload standard they are. That is a significant reflection of the quality of defense when caseload levels aren't staggering for the defenders. Another element of the process, and again, we're going along with the steps of the criminal justice process. And the next step we have is bail assistance, and Deb Dietrich is here to talk about that.
Thanks, Joe. OAR has been providing bail since about 1976 when it was founded, but it was private funds that were used for many, many years. There were loans and donations made to the OAR bail fund. About a decade ago, the county made a commitment to put money into OAR's bail fund, and that has been a pretty steady commitment ever since. In addition to the bail fund, OAR does contribute. Next year, it will be just over $200,000 for OAR's ongoing operations. And I've come to the legislature, I think, four times since I've been with OAR and asked for more bail monies, and they've been granted each time that I've requested them. There is a new statutory $2,000 limit on the amount of bails that can be done by a not-for-profit charitable bail fund. There was a law passed by the state last year that put a lot of new restrictions on bail funds, and we have been working to comply with the law. But OAR does bail up to $2,500 with a $500 copay from the client or their families. And that's how we're saying we're staying within the $2,000 limit. We also do require a cosigner on bails in excess of $1,000. That is waived on occasion after looking at a situation. If someone doesn't have a member of the family who can cosign or a friend who can cosign, we look at other considerations to try to get someone out of jail. Last year, OAR got 68 individuals out of jail, saving the county an estimated $459,000 in averted board-out costs. This year, we've done 56 year-to-date, which is about a $340,000 savings. But we don't just do bail. OAR's bail work is only a portion of what we do. And doing bail isn't just writing a check for the amount of bail. It's having a weekly check-in with our clients. It's helping them find work or housing when they're out on bail. It's not just a writing of a check and you know, saying, okay, there you go. We try to keep contact with people that call in weekly. We do a lot of other things, too. We do the assigned counsel applications. We're up at the jail 4 days a week and do the intake so that people can get rapidly assigned counsel. We also do applications for public assistance and applications for alcohol and substance abuse treatment programs. The drug court, there is a certified alcohol and substance abuse counselor at DSS who does the actual evaluation. We're not evaluators, but we do the paperwork that tries to get people into treatment. There's also a direct phone line from the jail to OAR because it costs so much now for people to call from the jail to their families' homes. And frequently, a credit card or huge deposits required by the for the family to be able to collect calls from the jail. So we have pretty constant use of that direct line and set up phone appointments for family members to come in and be able to talk to their loved ones. We also provide transportation 2 times a week for visiting hours for family and friends, and have been doing that through a volunteer service for over 28 years. And the Friends Society, the Society of Friends, has been a huge support in that. We also have a drop-in center that's pretty well utilized, and there's a computer there where people can come in to locate housing, jobs, and help us, ask us to refer them to other services. So OAR offers a pretty comprehensive range of services to both those incarcerated and those who are formerly incarcerated. Is it sufficient? No, it's not sufficient. There's more to be done as far as easing someone's transition back into the community. But we're very rare in having a bail fund. This county is one of the unique few who have something like this. The Bronx Defenders just started one because one of our former interns went down to the Bronx Defenders to work and took it to the Bronx. Unfortunately, it was also that created the state legislation, which puts a lot more rules and restrictions on us. But at any rate, there are other counties looking at our bail fund now, but Tompkins County has been really at the forefront. That's all.
Many of you in making comments about our plan have talked about alternatives to incarceration. You're preaching to the choir. This is a county that has committed itself to alternatives to incarceration that run deep and broad. Pat Buchel, who's the probation director, is here to give an overview of the programs that we currently do.
Thank you, Joe. First of all, I'd like to start out by saying that probation is the largest alternative to incarceration sentence that's used by the criminal courts. I checked our stats today. We currently have 660 open supervision cases within Tompkins County. And also, it's very important to know that, yes, we are very committed to alternative programming for probation-eligible cases. And at any time, it is a written policy in the department that at any time a probation officer...
Actually, Pat, hang on just a sec.
No problem.
I was actually waiting to see which one of you guys was going to give first and drop your arm. No, nothing. That was tough work. I was sitting here watching that. That's got to be.
Yep.
I think we're all set. Yep.
As I was saying, the probation department operates a ATI, Alternative to Incarceration Screening Committee. And at any time when a probation officer is considering a sentence of incarceration for an individual, whether it's at the violation of probation stage or at the pre-sentence investigation stage, All probation-eligible cases must be screened by this committee, which is made up of a supervisor and two senior probation officers. And the case is presented to the committee and run through all the alternative programming that is offered within the department for consideration. So you heard Deb Dietrich talk about OAR and the bail fund program. We also offer a pretrial release program through the probation department. I have a probation assistant who goes up to the jail every day, Monday through Friday, and she interviews anyone who has been committed there and has bail set, and if they agree to the interview, they are interviewed. She collects all kinds of social information from the person, and she comes back to the office and contacts employers and family members to determine their ties to the community. We also run the case through an actuarial risk assessment that tells us the risk level of failure to appear in court. And we gather all that information and make a recommendation to the court, and there are a number of different recommendations we can make. We can recommend that the person be released on their own recognizance. We can recommend that they be released under the supervision to probation, whether that's directly to Beth, where they have to check in with her up to once to five times a week, or they can be released to probation under electronic monitoring, or they can be released to probation to the day reporting program, so a number of options there. We can also recommend reduced bail or continue bail. So the judge gets that report and makes a decision regarding release status pretty early on in the process, basically their first appearance back to court. The Service Work Alternative Program is our oldest ATI program. It's been around since the mid-1980s. Started out very small, but now it's a program where we offer a supervised community service program every day of the week. It is for our low-risk offenders and nonviolent offenders, and it can be used initially at sentencing as an alternative to jail, or it can be used as a graduated sanction for noncompliant behavior during their period of supervision. So we may end up violating someone, taking them back to court, and recommending that they do community service as a sanction instead of doing jail time. So that's how that works. Okay, our greatest risk caseload formerly was called intensive supervision probation, but this is reserved for offenders who have lengthy legal histories, who have failed at prior probation sentences or have failed at substance abuse treatment in the past, and who also score as greatest risk of recidivism and violent recidivism based on our actuarial risk and needs instrument. That's a state instrument that is given to us by the Office of Probation and Correctional Alternatives to use in making these decisions. So the idea behind the greatest risk caseload is that the caseloads are smaller, and it allows the probation officer to provide very intensive monitoring and addresses errant behavior early on. And it also allows the probation officer to return the case to court immediately so that we can, again, look at possibly other programming, alternative programming for them to get them back on track. We also offer the day reporting program, which is located in the Community Justice Building. It's a structured program that operates from 9 in the morning to 1:30 in the afternoon. It's kind of like a classroom setting where it's very structured throughout the day. There are different classes and activities that they have to attend. We offer substance abuse education. There's a life skills, GED instruction, and employment services are kind of the key components of that program. Participants are mandated to attend by the criminal courts as a condition of pretrial release. So someone could be released from the jail into day reporting so that they're given a little bit more oversight. It can be a condition of probation or a conditional discharge, and it can be a drug court sanction. We also offer the service to parolees who may be coming out, and the parole officer thinks that that may be a good stepping stone for them. Length of program varies according to the court. The judge has the discretion to order any number of days. And again, we use this as a graduated sanction for noncompliance in lieu of incarceration. It can be used at the violation of probation stage for someone who just needs that added extra monitoring and supervision. We are committed to day reporting. We are going to be housed in the Human Services Building very soon. We're very looking forward to being in the Human Services Building and having probation all under one roof. It's going to be a great asset to the community. And we are slated to start that 2014, we hope, about 18 months. We should be up and running. Electronic monitoring is yet another ATI option that we offer. It's an ankle bracelet that uses cell tower and GPS to restrict and track an offender's movements. There's a lot of rules with this program. A person has to agree to follow the rules. They have to be able to agree to their in and out times from their homes. The probation officer tracks their movements through a web-based program, and we get to see where they are, and it's pretty much real time. It refreshes every 5 minutes, so we can see exactly where they are. We know when they're not attending things that they should be attending. We know when they are in areas they're not supposed to be in and when they are in areas that they are supposed to be in. So it's a good monitoring tool. And finally, we have the drug courts. And what we offer here are two drug courts. We have a misdemeanor drug court and a felony-level drug court. Misdemeanor drug court's been in operation since 1998, and the felony-level drug court began in the year 2000. This is also for high-risk offenders. It's designed to break the cycle of addiction and criminal activity. The idea is swift and consistent responses to errant behavior, and it encourages positive behavior, the whole goal being to reduce recidivism. So here today we have Judge Rowley. He provides the judicial oversight for the felony drug court. And it's a team approach where the probation officers provide the probation supervision, the judge provides the judicial oversight, and along with that, there's substance abuse treatment, regular drug testing. The participant is given employment and education services, and there's use of graduated incentives and sanctions, including some of those ATIs that I just spoke about. Judge, would you like to make any further comments?
Sure. About that? Thank you. I apologize for getting over here late. And let me just say by way of introduction that I'm grateful to see community interest in our alternative to incarceration program. We've been at this for 25 years, and we need all the help we can get. The issues related to incarceration are complex. At their core, I think we all recognize poverty, racism, sexism. There's all sorts of poverty. I think is one of our biggest indicators, but we've got problems that are bigger than us, and we have been very creatively working on this for a very long time. I was just jotting down four programs that have come and gone because we tried them and they didn't accomplish what we hoped to, but we've got at least a dozen programs that are up and running. The drug courts, we were innovators in all of the drug courts. We actually have three operating and two other specialty courts, compliance courts. And they largely operate invisible to the community, and it's unfortunate because it's a remarkable effort and it's accomplishing remarkable things. There's 65 defendants right now supervising the felony drug court. These are all prison-eligible defendants who are in the community because they're being supervised by a highly experienced group of professionals who come together on a weekly basis to collaborate on the supervision. The goal of the felony drug court is to help people succeed with achieving long-term sobriety and therefore not repeating the felony criminal offense or behavior that they've already engaged in. And in fact, the 66 that are in the program right now are the highest risk. There's a lot of people that don't qualify, because the probation department has lesser levels of supervision. This is a very high level of supervision, high level of intrusion, and it has a lot of success and a lot of data supporting the success of the model. The city drug court was opened in 1998. At that time, it was the first small city outside of New York for a small city and the first upstate city to have the drug court program outside of Rochester. Been a very successful program as well. We also have a family treatment court, which has 45 parents in it. While not directly related to alternatives to incarceration, we're still talking about a similar population of addicted parents whose children are in the foster care system, and they're seen in court on a weekly basis for up to a couple of years with the goal of trying to reunite families. I also run a sex offense compliance court. This represents sex offenders who are in the community and not in state prison, because we're hoping that with the strict level of compliance and participation in the treatment process that they can both make the necessary changes and do it without putting the public at risk. It's a pretty risky business, but we have been doing this for 3 or 4 years. We haven't yet had a defendant reoffend while in the program. We've had technical violations which have resulted in resentencing. And finally, there's the Integrated Domestic Violence Court, which has about 100 cases in it currently, and that's, again, a collaborative effort to bring together the various community partners to try to enhance safety for victims of domestic violence and to hold offenders accountable by regular compliance appearances. They appear in court every month before me to see whether or not they're in compliance with the orders of protection and with the other orders of probation or conditional discharge. So as you can see, I've got a lot to say about alternatives to incarceration. I've got a lot of history with it, too, and I'm not even the person with the oldest involvement in this, but that's the first 2 cents I want to offer.
Thank you, Judge. Thank you. In terms of how we monitor how we're doing with the alternatives, we have an organization called CJATI. Susie Cook chairs that group. And Susie, if you can explain here what CJATI is all about.
Thanks, Joe. The CJATI, it's Criminal Justice and Alternatives to Incarceration. It's the board for, I think it's this one, that the county has. We started with the Criminal Justice Board in 1975. And then in 1984, when the county created the Alternatives to Incarceration Board, shortly thereafter, the county realized these two operate together, so they combined them. And that's when we became CJATI. On that board sits 22 people, which is every spoke in our criminal justice wheel. It is the judges. It's probation. It's mental health. Started out with 15, and as the need has grown, we've put more people on this board for youth services, CDRC for mediation, mental health, and a bunch of people at every point. We try to monitor the jail population, look at our ATIs, see how they're doing. We're supposed to meet quarterly under a state mandate. We choose to meet monthly because we think there's a lot of work that we can do. One of the things that we undertook as we're looking at, you know, how our system works and how can we grease the wheels to make sure things are working well is we did a strategic action plan in 2007, which was going through, we pulled all the key players in and met to see exactly how can we improve things, where do we need to do things better. And out of that, it was a year-long intensive process. One of the things we found was that we have great ATIs, and we need to make sure that people know about them. We wanted the magistrates and justices and people to know what we had available so that they use that. And in an effort to do that, probation director Pat Buchel, and she has even before she was director, gone out to the magistrates, and she's done a manual for them to see what services we have that they can draw upon as an alternative instead of jail. One of the other things we did was looked at trying to make outcomes better as people were discharged from the jail. So we looked at these re-entry type philosophies, and now actually planning starts before they're discharged from the jail, looking at what resources they need when they come out, whether it's workforce to help them try to obtain employment,
see what they have for housing, is there substance abuse issues. And as part of the substance abuse piece, what we saw was that there was a lag in people who needed treatment and getting them out of jail and into treatment. So the county and the state put money towards a position that actually goes into the jail and does substance abuse assessments to see what people need. That information goes to the court, and they can more speedily move people into treatment and out of the jail. We do have a very, very dedicated group of people who work very hard to monitor, and I think my state rep tells me we're one of the best in the state at what we do.
Thanks, Susie. I'm watching the clock, and I'll try to go quickly. I have the next series of slides. I'll try to go fairly quickly through there, but I'll spend a little time on a couple that I think are really important. We understand that the work that we're talking about here today, that all of you are interested in, doesn't begin and end with the criminal justice system. This is a county that has committed itself to a broad range of human services to address needs as early as is possible, beginning with youth programs. We spend more in terms of our own money for youth development programs than the three largest upstate counties combined. We're committed to mental health programs and quality mental health programs, and this is a legislature that has recognized that and has made financial commitments to maintaining the quality of mental health programs. I think if you understand this county, you know that we also support a very broad range of other human services. As an example, I pulled out a slide that shows our commitment to youth programming compared to the four largest upstate counties in New York State in terms of per capita spending. So this may give a good reflection of our commitment to youth programs in this county. And we're not just talking about criminal justice. We're talking about an entire spectrum of programs. What really counts is the result. If all these ATI programs were just done for the sake of doing them, it would be one thing. But we think that they have had the right kind of result in terms of reducing our jail population. The incarceration in Tompkins is among the lowest in New York State. If you look at our population, again, standardized by, if you look at the jail population standardized by the size of the county, you can see that we rank 53rd of 57 upstate counties in terms of the rate of incarceration. The ATI programs are working. They're reflected in this very low rate of incarceration in our county. We know that there was an interest in unsentenced individuals who were in the jail. So we also took a look to make sure we're okay there, too, and we rank exactly the same in terms of unsentenced as we do in total jail population, 53rd to 57. This one's a little hard to understand. I'll go really quickly through it, though. What we did is to take a look at what the incarceration rate is in every county in New York State. And we said, okay, what if we had the same rate of incarceration in Tompkins County that they do in these other counties? And we found it pretty interesting that Allegheny County seems to have the largest rate of incarceration in upstate New York. So if we had that same rate as Allegheny, we would have 280 people in our jail. The red lines are neighboring counties. Broome County, for example, if we had the same rate of incarceration as Broome, we would have 254, Cayuga 241, Seneca 222, Chemung County, again, if we had the same rate of incarceration as Chemung, 216 people would be in jail here. We drop down to Ontario. We often compare ourselves to Ontario, kind of college town. We would have, if at that same rate, 186 people in jail, and so forth down the line until you get to us. Our average population, based on state data and our own, is 90 people in jail at any given time. So we think this reflects the proof in the pudding of the effectiveness of the ATI programs, that the rate of incarceration is very low. In terms of lengths of stay, we looked at it because the numbers are, you'll see in a chart here, you need to look at it as the median stay is 8 days. The average is 21 because some people have been in there for some time. So the average is 21 days. The mode, most people are in there for 1 day or less. And there's the graphic of the lengths of stay for unsentenced individuals. And you can see how it skews far to the left. The most people who find their way to our jail are released within 1 day. You can see how it trails off after that. So that brings us to today. And I'm going to ask Ken Lansing, the sheriff, to just kind of explain where we are today, and then I'll take it back and talk about some process things.
First of all, I may be the new sheriff, but
I've got a lot of experience when it comes to CJATI because I was a member of that board while I was the chief of police in Cuyahoga Heights for 10 years. So I know the commitment this county makes, and I agree with it 100%, and I backed it even when I was just the chief of police in Cuyahoga Heights. With that being said, also, since we took over as the sheriff, we have accommodated many great programs that have been brought to us by various agencies and religious groups, and we've done our best to make sure that they can come to our jail and give the programs necessary to give the necessary stuff for hopefully the people that are in our jail not to have to come back, and they have the skills to live a better life when they leave our population. With that being said, as you can see up there, we're licensed when this jail was made for 75 beds. The state variance, which is 18 beds that they allow us to have, but we have to file for that every 6 months. And at any time, they can pull that. And they did at one time, unfortunately, for the previous years of 04, 05, and 06. And it cost the taxpayers of this county a lot of money. We don't want to see that again. And that's one of the reasons that our staff started thinking about what can we do. I met with the commissioner in January of 2011, shortly after I took over, just to get an idea of what Albany expected from us. And they wanted to see some kind of movement. And I promised them, though, that we weren't going to build a new jail. I knew that that was not something that we really needed here, that we'd do our best to accommodate the population with the existing jail that we had. So our staff did start thinking outside the box a little bit of how we might be able to do that. And this is why this project has come about. And another reason this project has come about is that the average shows that we average 8 board outs. Obviously, the 7 beds leaves us just short of 1. Is it going to cure everything? But it surely will help a lot. And the biggest thing for us is it's very difficult for us to decide who we're going to board out. First of all, we know the impact on the inmates and their families. Also, their legal counsel, the difficulty. In fact, today I got a phone call from a local attorney concerned about how he's going to represent one of his board outs, and I promised him that I would do my best to take care of that, and I have made the arrangements to take care of that. So we are concerned, and we do care, and this project came about because of that. We do care. And as you can see, this is why we felt we needed to give you 7 beds. It's something I want to do, spend more money? No, but it's not. It's going to save us money, and it also will prevent the hardship that comes upon our people that end up being a part of our jail population.
So that brings us to kind of where we started. Now we have a few more slides. We'll get through them fairly quickly, but again, it brings us to the proposal that we're discussing today, which is to repurpose that recreation space inside that 7 beds and then replace that space with a sheltered outdoor facility on the larger grounds in the back of the jail. A question has arisen about costs. Several of you ask about costs and how we're going to pay for it. The design and the estimated construction cost is $900,000. You've asked how we're going to pay for it. We will borrow the money. We will fold that into probably a larger borrowing. We would expect to borrow it over a period of 20 years. Right now, conservatively, the interest rate we've assumed is 4%. Could be less than that, but we've assumed 4%. And if that's the case, then our annual debt service would average about $65,000 a year. Then the question is, what's the net out-of-pocket cost to the county if we do that? Well, it depends on how many people you think we can avoid boarding out because of this expansion. And rather than to make any kind of prediction, this is kind of a pick'em. So if you look at this chart, and by the way, the hard copies of this are in the back of the room, and it will be on the webpage as well if anybody wants to see it. So if you believe that we will only avoid one board out, that means that we would save $29,000 in board out costs. That would go against the $65,000 expense of borrowing. So the net cost of the county in that case of a low board out impact would be $36,000. And then you take it all the way up. If we can avoid 7 board outs, we can fill all those beds with avoided board outs, then the county could actually save $138,000 a year if that's the assumed reduction of board outs. So it does look as if we make this investment, we can save money. We can also improve the quality of life for the individuals who would not be boarded out in another county. The last series here, there has been a concern about how public we've been in the discussion of this plan. So we went back and did a really quick review of what's in the public record, what's on the web page, and so it's clear we've been talking about this in some detail for over a year. We began in September of 2012 when the sheriff and undersheriff came to the Public Safety Committee to discuss this back-of-the-napkin concept. We then took it to another committee. We then kind of took the planning farther. In February of 2013, there's updates. We got more serious and more formal as 2013 went on, to the point of in June there was a formal presentation of the Labella plan to the Capital Plan Review Committee, followed by the presentation of the same plan to Public Safety, followed by an approval of the plan by Public Safety. We did a full legislative presentation in the middle part of August before a vote, 2 weeks before a vote. We then brought it back to budget for approval. And on September 3rd, the legislature approved the plan. So you can see the progression of public review and public discussion. In terms of the next steps, there will be a review of the final design by the Public Safety Committee. We expect this will happen over the next few months. Those of you who have been attending these meetings know that I've said it's my expectation. We'll be back sometime in the springtime for a binding resolution after we have final designs in plan and would ask the legislature at that time to finance the project through the authorization of a bond. And that's what we got.
Thanks, Joe. I think I'll defer to the longest standing person here who has the most experience with this entire sphere of the criminal justice system, and that would be Judge Rowley. Do you have any last words before we get going on the public part of it?
Well, let me just say with regard to the beds themselves that, if we come up with some new ideas and we're able to implement some proposals over the next few years to even further reduce incarceration, that would be great. But right now, it frankly is a human rights problem that we're using boarding out as our strategy. I think you have to be practical about this. There's over 20 judges in Tompkins County who are putting people in jail. Now, there's no one place to say this is the problem, this is not the problem, it's this judge or that judge. This is a system, and the system is complex, and when you crunch the numbers, you've just seen them. We've got too many people on a daily basis, given the variances and all that. I can tell you, and I hope you can appreciate, what a deprivation it is for a person who's already being deprived by the fact that they're incarcerated, that they are not incarcerated locally, where visitation cannot occur, the evaluations cannot occur, the consultation with attorneys, the GED program, any of the programs, the AA meetings, NA meetings, none of those things. These folks are sent to Shenango County, sent to Broome County. They're sent to wherever's got an open bed. And these decisions are made on a daily basis, and they're made depending on how many people under 21, how many females, how many people have to be segregated for behavior reasons or mental health reasons. So it's a complex thing that happens. The bottom line is that these vans are running constantly, and it's a disaster. So this part of the plan where we say, you know what, looking at these numbers, we need these beds so we can have the flexibility of keeping Tompkins County residents or Tompkins County inmates within Tompkins County, I think this is the easy part. Improving the quality of the recreation space, that's the easy part. The hard parts are, you know, the bottom line issues. What are we doing with this many people in there? I don't care what the other counties are doing. We do a lot of things different than other counties, and we're almost at the lowest level of incarceration. Let's keep pushing it. We've got to balance a lot of things, but if we've got new ideas, better ideas, revisiting ideas, we are open to it. We meet every month, and we review these things, and we'll keep pushing it. But on the issue of just this project, failure to do this is a violation of the rights of Tompkins County citizens who end up in the Tompkins County Jail.
Thanks, Judge. back a month or so ago, you folks came out. You had a lot of questions for us. We promised to give you answers. Hopefully, we gave you a lot of answers here today in this presentation. We do have some time. I've got three folks signed up right now that would like to speak. I would suggest you have 3 minutes. It's just like any other public comment. Being that we have the luxury of having the folks in attendance who supervise a lot of the programs that people have had questions about, I would suggest that if you have a question, ask it versus, giving a statement. You can do what you want in your 3 minutes. But if you have a question as it pertains to this project, by all means, ask it. I appreciate the fact one of the things that we asked was that insofar as you could to try to submit questions ahead of time for consideration for this presentation. And you've done so. And, of course, we can't go word by word on every question that was submitted. So we kind of juxtaposed them, if you will, into some subject areas. And let me just hit on some. If hopefully they've been answered, but if not, keep it in the back of your mind. That may be a question you'd want to ask one of the panelists here. Did you study the jail population to know who is serving time so that you could figure out to reduce the unsentenced population? That is ongoing. It's ongoing all the time. It's ongoing especially when we go to CJATI meetings every month. It's done daily by the correction staff, by Lieutenant Bunce and his staff. So hopefully that was answered. Are you maximizing your use of alternatives to incarceration? We certainly think, we in Tompkins County think that we do alternatives to incarceration better, even much better, than other counties in the state. And that's evidenced by the low rates of incarceration. Why don't you invest money committed to the renovation into ATIs and mental health programs? Again, you can ask the question, but I think it's been stated that we do. And let me just say that because we think we do, doesn't mean that you think we do. So, again, if you have questions on that, by all means, ask them. Is the jail population dominated by those in for petty drug crimes? I think we've already answered that. No, that's not the case. As a matter of fact, only 6% of the arrests total are drug-related, as compared to 15% of the rest of upstate New York. That's theirs. And as you saw from the slides, felony drug arrests are the lowest in New York State. Next question, do we have an unusually high level of unsentenced inmates? That answer is also no. Outside of New York City, about 60% of inmates in county jails are unsentenced. I mean, that is where you go before you are sentenced. That's the way it works. In Tompkins County, we're actually only 53% as of last year. How much will the project cost? Several questions on that. I'm not sure. Was that in the presentation?
Yeah.
Okay. I thought it was. But you're certainly welcome to ask questions on that as well. And no, this one doesn't make any sense. So will you have a public meeting to discuss this? That's what we're doing. So I have three folks signed up, or four, I guess, right now. Again, you have 3 minutes, and if you want to ask a specific question to a specific person, by all means, do so. Martha, you got a question, or what's that?
Just getting light.
Oh, okay. All right. And Susan Hatch said she had to leave, so. Yeah, go on.
Do you want me to just read from here?
Nope. Right up at the microphone, please.
Well, I'm here to support the work of public safety agents. There are a lot of them in the community. But to also restate how important the role of community members is to their work. I'm thrilled that younger members have come to speak about these perspectives. That is, younger than me. I was a part of a county review of the public safety in Tompkins County years ago. That review brought together many community agency perspectives and much data so that a picture of the strengths and weaknesses of the system did emerge in facts, a picture that could inform the county about what improvements were necessary. Better alternatives to incarceration programs and policies were the result. In the intervening years, however, county personnel, defense attorneys, the district attorney, judges, and justices of the peace on many benches have changed. A new review would be advised to save the taxpayers of Tompkins County $1 million. Furthermore, some staff and programs may have been cut that could be refunded. Staffing is key to these things, and the staffing in these kinds of programs is absolutely essential. I suspect that there can be improvements when I hear that 53% of the jailed members of the community are local, have local family and community connections and roots and support that can't make bail and are in jail awaiting a court date. And often, and we need to know how often, many are released without a conviction. This points to a need for a review of the timetable and the processes of jailing. It points to more promotion of community intervention at earlier times would be a good thing. I support the consideration of the Burlington, Vermont program that you're looking at, and whatever else comes from a real factual review of the system as a whole. This is too important and expensive a decision to make without a full examination of all the facts. And there are some facts here, but a lot of them aren't absolutely precise. You need even more facts to satisfy a community that's really ardent about this. Thanks.
Francis Carver.
I'm going to waive my 3 minutes. Thank you.
Okay. Dr. Nagel.
Good afternoon. My name is Mecca Nagel. I'm from Cortland, but I was, it's a bit of a deja vu. Some 10 years ago, we were at this two times, and we thought we prevailed and really settled for ATI. Since then, I've also wisened up. I wrote a few academic books on jails and prisons, and I've keep my head out for international strategies to reduce jailing populations. First of all, you mentioned the length of stay, LOS, 21 days, the medium, the most being 1 day. This is actually not different from other jurisdictions. I've just went through a big file of the California system on assessing your jail population. It's the exact same number, right? And I'm just wondering, given the fabulous efforts that you folks have done, that Judge Raleigh mentioned, at least in the last decade, if not more, on alternatives, couldn't we reduce that even more so that the median would be 1 day, if at all, right? So that's one consideration. My main point here is really to look at justice reinvestment strategies, and I have a lovely cartoon on that. What it would mean to decarcerate, to focus less on police, prison, jails, and courts, and to invest in jobs, housing, quality schools, urban gardening, clinics, free clinics for drug treatment, mental health, and children's programs, to say a few. We actually, to share with you some ideas, there's the Center for Community Alternatives that's located in Syracuse and elsewhere in the state. And the headline here for the annual report is CCA gets results, and they're rather impressive. My question to you all is, in terms of the success rates that Judge Rawley, you lined out, you know, the various courts, alternative courts, which are still punitive, right? You're not succeeding, then you're going back to jail. And to folks involved in the decarceration movement, that mandatory approach is still rather negative, and the success rates tend to pale in terms of other more strength-based programs such as CCAs. CCAs cost an average of $11,000 per participant. It's not cheap, but you get 90% of the youth participants that are not rearrested for at least 1 year after their enrollment, and many of them volunteer in the organization. One consideration, too, is, of course, that I'm sure OAR deals with the permanent cast of outcast people, right? We don't have to read Michelle Alexander to understand those issues. So I ask now if Tompkins County has considered a ban the box. I can't read.
Says time's up.
Time's up.
Go ahead and wrap up.
Yeah, thank you. So ban the box, I'm working that within SUNY. I'm employed by SUNY Cortland, so that one doesn't have to disclose one's criminal history when applying to college. But many cities around the country have instated such a program for employment opportunities so that people truly can get a second chance. Thank you very much.
Okay. Hang on just a sec. Could you go back? Are you going to be forwarding that material?
That would be my pleasure. Sure.
Okay. Yeah, you can make arrangements to do that. Does anybody want to just raise your hand if you want to comment to it? Go ahead.
The organization that she just mentioned, the Center for Community Action through Onondaga County, our program has just applied for a grant with them. And we are going to be contracting with them for next year, starting next year, for a defender-based advocacy program. And we applied for that money this year. We should be starting in January with that program.
Very good.
Brian, I've got a couple comments.
Yep.
And we had that program about 15 years ago. It was very effective, and then it got caught in the squeeze, and that's what happens with the cycling of these things. On the larger question of incarceration, I mean, obviously it's a stubborn issue, and it's true. I mean, these are all coercive by nature. These are individuals who have committed felony offenses, when we're talking about felony drug court, and if they've failed on probation before, they've already been to state prison, then we're still admitting them to the drug court program, especially under the new judicial diversion law, which allows the judge to use the discretion to allow someone into drug court, even though they're otherwise facing mandatory state incarceration. But you're right. I mean, if they weren't committing the felony crimes, and we're talking about mostly property crimes, but if you've had your house burglarized, or if you've had 20 houses in the neighborhood burglarized, which are some of the kinds of folks we have here, we have to, at this point, deal with the reality of incarceration. It's just simply part of our society. I think in many ways it's an ugly part of our society, but it is what it is. I can give you another example of where incarceration, where we fill up beds, and we've got the 19-year-old, 7-month pregnant woman who's shooting heroin. That's my case today. Already been kicked out of drug treatment, homeless. There's no place to go, and already been on electronic monitoring, already been at day reporting, already been on interim probation supervision, already been incarcerated. And so I can say, stay out of trouble, till the baby's born, or I can say, you know what, you're going to get your the rest of your care up at the Tompkins County Jail, and when that baby's born is when you're going to be released. You know, this is not always crystal clear. There's a lot of community issues that are involved here. This won't be the first clean baby born, because I've said we're not going to continue to expose your baby to heroin while you're through your last few months of pregnancy. These are complex issues, and I'm glad I haven't heard any comments suggest that you don't appreciate the audience, the complexity of this. This has taken our best thinking for a long time, and I don't know if Tim Joseph has said anything yet, but Tim was one of the fiercest opponents of jail expansion when, however many years ago, they said 160 beds is what you need in Tompkins County, and led the government opposition to that. And it's kind of funny, because back then it was fighting against those who insisted we had to build the bigger jail, and we fought that back. And now we're absolutely delighted to have renewed energy to look at this issue. Thanks. Okay.
Paula Jonite.
Thank you. It's Paula Ioannida, and I'm part of the Sean Greenwood Working Group as well as the Stop the Jail Expansion Coalition. I had three questions. One is for OAR Director Ms. Dietrich. If you had more funds for a new staff person as well as more money for the bail program, would you be able to assist more people to get out of jail? The second question is for Director Buchel, who talked about the pretrial release program. If you had more staffing as well as funding for that pretrial process, would you say that you could speed up the process through which you release people who met the qualifications to not stay in jail? In other words, speed up that process. And the third question I had was around the sheriff, for Sheriff Lansing, and you mentioned the need to show the New York State Commissioner some kind of progress on in order to not pull the variance. Was that solicited? Was that something that came from the New York State, or something that you actually pursued with the commissioner as a way to, you know, initiate this program in 2000 or this proposed expansion in 2012? Thank you.
Thank you. Do you want to take those in order?
I'll answer. Yes and yes. We had one other client service worker until about 3 years ago when the county went through terrible fiscal times, and we sustained an elimination of one client service worker. So if we had another client service worker, I think we could do 10 to 12 more bails a year. It's not astronomical, but it's because the bail isn't just writing the check, as I said earlier. But everyone sustained cuts during those hard economic times, and we certainly did.
Thank you.
Okay.
I would say no to your question. The probation assistant who's assigned to the jail, she has no problems conducting the interviews of everyone who needs to be interviewed that day. She has no issues coming back to the office and completing those reports in a timely way. Also, sometimes in very short turnaround time, so that information is to the court by the time that person reappears before the judge. So I think that we are adequately staffed in that program. Thank you.
And to answer your question, as far as was this a part of the plan, because I had no plan other than to find out what some of the problems were, why our variances were taken away, so I could get a better grasp on what I may be able to do. There's no guarantee that this is going to guarantee that. Originally, we were able to file for variances for a year. Now they've put the squeeze on us to do it every 6 months. It had nothing to do with it. A plan. I had no plan at that time other than I was going to try to help the taxpayers of this county not to have to experience the possibility of them taking our variances again. And there is no guarantee of that, unfortunately. But this idea came up later on. As I stated, I met him right after I took office. So.
Sorry, I just had one more follow-up question because it was mentioned by Mr.
Mariano,
that this would be done on public debt. In other words, you would borrow the money to do the jail expansion And my question is, I mean, part of what's coming up for us is that alternative to incarceration programs, I'm assuming, but this is the question, can public debt be used to fund such programs? In other words, do you actually have to have the revenues in hand if we wanted to assign $1 million to OAR, for example, or can that actually be borrowed on bond as well, or is that only for infrastructure projects?
The latter. So we can only borrow for brick and mortar. We can't borrow for operating costs. That's why we would borrow for this physical improvement, but we couldn't borrow $1 million and give it to OAR. Could I, though, kind of expand on Deb's answer to your question? I think she was clear, and we tried to make it clear in the presentation. When Deb says we need more money for the bail fund, we provide additional money for the bail fund. So that's not an issue. Her staffing issue is one thing, but in terms of an adequate supply of funding for the bail fund, the legislature has been very good about responding to requests for necessary funding.
Yeah. It's just that there's something more sinister going on that we're highly aware of, one of which is that the New York State is increasingly displacing costs onto counties to build these jails, right? And I don't know if you are aware of this trend that throughout New York State, after they've exhausted sort of state funds to build state prisons, right, now one of the new tactics is to displace these costs onto counties with, you know, the New York State Commissioner, which I don't know if you're aware is a very unique position. It doesn't exist in other states. And so I think part of what we're trying to say that maybe we're not communicating quite well is that we're trying to interrupt the logic that is a part of a larger national trend. And that although I know on the ground here it looks like, you know, this is a good compromise, what we're trying to say is that you open up that little door, you're opening up the door to the larger logic. So that's just for me to comment and not necessarily to ask. Thanks.
Thank you. Gino Bush.
Hey, I want to ask you a question, Brian.
Sure.
At one of the meetings, I don't know if it was the last meeting, Shawnee asked you if you would come to the community, and you responded by saying, yeah, if the chief of police can come with you. I found that very disrespectful to our community and the community of people of color and poor people. And that you said this here is a community meeting today. It's not a community meeting because people from the community are not here today. They working or, you know, they home or whatever. It's not people from the community. That's why I ask for people to come to the community and talk about these issues. But you don't want to. People don't want to. And the other thing I want to say is I want to thank Julia and Deb for the hard work they put in into their agencies. Unbelievable. I work with Deb. I'm on the board of directors at OAR. I know how hard she worked to keep the 82 running. If it wasn't for her, it wouldn't be what it is today. And the same thing with the assigned counsel, as far as Julia is concerned. Her hard work into that agency is phenomenal. But I want to ask you folks want to stop bullshitting? Come out in the community and talk to the people. You don't do that. People don't even know who you are. I'm so tired of that bullshit. The only one that comes out is Pam McAfee and Ms. Claiborne. Those are only two people I see out in the community. The rest of you, I don't even see you or hear from you. Nothing. And I'm serving as a liaison between a lot of people. Today I was on the phone for over 5 hours trying to help two men get jobs who just got out of prison. They come to me and ask for help because ain't nobody out here to give them the help they need. So I say a lot of this is just a bunch of hogwash meant to make people feel good for a minute and then that's it. But the people that are putting in the work, like the people in the Sean Greenwood Working Group and other people out here in the community, you just totally ignore like we ain't nothing. And you ignore the people in the community. Thank you.
Did you want me to respond? You singled me out, so do you want me to respond? Okay. The young lady that you referred to was asking me to come to wherever, Southside or GIAC or whatever, to talk about basically the segments of the population that are overrepresented in the jail population because they're the ones that are most frequently arrested. That's what she asked me.
She also asked you to come out to the community, and you said you wouldn't come now.
Right.
You said, should I come with the chief of police?
I said I would come with the chief of police because they're the ones that do the arresting, not me, not the county legislature.
But I mean, I'd be you are part of the government of this county. That's what I'm talking about.
Right.
And you got a position here. You're making some money here, too, right? You're getting paid today, ain't you, from the county legislature? All right. Y'all getting paid. So y'all need to get out here and do something.
Okay. Judge?
I had two comments. First, Gino, that if you want the judge to come down, just give me the invitation. I'd be happy to come down and answer questions at Southside or wherever you want. I just want to take the moment, though, and I appreciate the comments about the larger context, and I'm sure any legislature here can talk to you about the push from the state to the local level, and the director of probation can tell you about the loss of state aid as the responsibility for costs of supervision have been borne more and more by the counties. So what's really happening when you see these numbers of our surrounding counties, you're seeing choices by counties where they say, we can't afford to do this. If the state's not going to pay us to have probation do the quality job that they should be doing, then we're just going to incarcerate more people. This county's putting the money in there, making the choice to put the money in there. All these programs are making the choice to put the money in there. But it really is, you're right, the bigger picture is that we're just lucky that we've got the values we have and the work that we're doing and the coordination that we do. But this is a disaster statewide on a lot of levels. And if you really want to look for disaster, look at our state prison system. Now, we don't have input into that. It's remarkable how little there's only two judges in the county who can send people to prison. You know, there's 20-something who can send them to jail. But we got to be clear about that. But when eventually prison is the sentence, we have virtually no say over where they go, what programming they get, when they get out, and most of all, we have no say over what happens when they're released back to the community. Now, an intelligent approach where you had a reentry system, because reentry from the jail is important, reentry from prison is essential. And we've got people who are doing like short-term incarceration come out onto probation, they go into all these programs, they get all the support. I'm not saying we couldn't do better, but we've got a lot. There is nothing coming out of the prison system. Parole is not even babysitting. I mean, it's just checking in a couple times a month, peeing a cup. So we've got, and if you really want to look for an issue right now, look at the special housing unit abuses in the state prison system, and judges have no say over that as well. Our prison system is it's of great concern, and I wish I had the time to try to organize county judges with regard to the conditions in the prison system, because I think there's an awful lot of work that we need to do there. So just since I had the soapbox for a minute, I thought I'd take it.
Joanne Sepulveda-Dennis.
Hi. Thank you very much for coming out today, everybody. I really appreciate it. And is there a member of the Ithaca Police Force here? Or is this just the Sheriff's Department represented today? Okay. So, Judge Rowley, thank you for coming today. I haven't met you before. It's a pleasure. Thank you for accepting Gino's invitation, and we'll be looking forward to seeing you go, and perhaps Mr. Robeson would join you, as well as Mr. Lansing and the Chief of Police of Ithaca Department would go as well. I just disagree with one thing you said, Judge Rowley, and that is that you said that these problems are bigger than we are. I disagree, sir, respectfully. The problems that we have are our own doing, and we have to get to the bottom of them to solve them. So some of them, obviously, I think a lot of people here are going to talk about racism today. You're actually the only one that actually spoke that word. That's disappointing to me. We have a lot of issues with racism, homophobia, that are driving perhaps a capacity at the jail, that we need to address those quickly and completely. Exactly what are the total costs for the three-phase expansion in total? Mr. Marion, can you answer that question?
Well, for the, and this is kind of a...
Do you want me to continue before I...
I can
my
answer
3 minutes
right now.
Is up, or?
You can answer.
Okay.
Yeah.
The expansion, the renovation that we're talking about now, the seven beds, but to design them and construct them, the estimate is $900,000. If we go beyond that, because there is a conceptual phase three out there that would require the sheriff to vacate the public safety building for all the civil and uniformed services, vacate that building and then backfill that space with additional beds. I think the cost of adding additional beds was relatively low. I'm recalling less than $200,000 just for beds. However, the cost of building new headquarters for the sheriff and the civil division and road patrol and all that goes with that would be quite high. I'm sure it would be significant, and we have not put a pencil to that.
Is that a several million dollar, I would assume?
It could be.
Is that a
proposal? I don't
know.
And again, at this point, I wouldn't want to speculate, but it's a cost that was not stated in the architect's estimates,
okay.
But it's a significant
I think where
cost.
The confusion is that it's been stated in the public as a three-phase expansion.
Yeah.
So we want to know the entirety of the funds that will be bonded, which then the taxpayer will have to pay by a half.
Yeah, and I think we should be very clear that third phase is very conceptual. Very much in the future. Nobody is committed to do that third phase.
Okay. So on the first one that we're talking about today, the $900,000, that contingency is only 10%. And being a builder, that is really very, very low considering the type of project you're talking about. So what happens when that 10% contingency is exceeded, sir?
Well, you phrase that as when the contingency
is
exceeded.
Let's say if it is. We can go on if.
Yeah, our goal is clear would clearly be to keep it within that budget.
Well, I understand that.
If it exceeds that, we would have to come back to the county legislature for additional authorization to pay the excess.
Would there be any fees associated with that?
Any fees?
Yes, if you have a contingency and then you go above your contingency and then you have to go back to the taxpayer to form another bond.
Well, there'd be no extraordinary fee. If you're looking at a scenario here, if you had to incur additional costs, you would probably package that in with the overall bond. So you would spread that cost over the same life of the bond. So it would have some effect on the annual debt service for the project.
Okay. Would the committee agree to a three-hour public conversation one evening so people don't have to miss work, or a Saturday? Every month for the first 6 months so we can bring information to the board for consideration that might, in essence, differ your opinion on the entire project. Anybody want to address that? Are you willing to meet with the community in the next 6 months, one day a month, for 3 hours?
I wouldn't commit to that.
Would you consider
what I would commit to?
Would you consider that?
Yeah, we'll consider anything. One thing you need to understand, and I think it was one of your questions, and it's kind of along those same lines, asking for what is the commitment in general of the Public Safety Committee to listen to the public, mm-hmm. not only about this issue but any issue. My answer is we operate under a committee system, and every year it changes. And there is no guarantee that one or any of us are going to be on the Public Safety Committee for 2014.
Does that change in January?
Yes.
And have you decided whether you would like to continue service for another year?
Have I decided?
Yes.
Public safety is my background, so...
That's why I'm asking you.
That's something that I would very much like to do. However, it's not my decision. I can voice my...
So is the committee chosen, or is it a volunteer?
Go ahead, Jim.
Let me answer simply. We elect a chair of the legislature every year. The chair of the legislature, in collaboration with the new vice chair, makes up the committees. So not one of us could say today strictly what committees we're going to be on. If we have a new chair of the legislature, which we probably will in January, you know, it's all up for grabs.
Okay. And the last one is for Sheriff Lansing, who I've never met before. How do you address the allegations of racism and targeting of the LGBTQ community in the city of Ithaca? And when was the last time that the police department was trained on diversity issues, sir?
What was the last part? I couldn't hear it.
When was the last time the police department or the corrections, actually both of you, trained or retrained on diversity issues?
Want to answer that? I'll have Captain Bunce answer that since he's in charge of the corrections facility. He'll be able to tell you because he keeps track of those records.
Yep. Obviously, I don't have exact training records, but we did put the entire corrections staff through diversity training approximately 1 year ago.
And who did that, this training, sir?
In-house.
So who was the trainer? And did you follow a, like the legislature just celebrated their workforce diversity? So did you, were you trained by the same people? Or are you saying that you trained your own people?
Yeah, I want to say that we had a lesson plan that we followed and went through with all of our staff.
And whose lesson plan was that, sir?
I don't recall.
Can you get that information to us?
I probably could.
Okay, thank you.
Joanne mentioned the city of Ithaca, and I think we should be really clear that the county sheriff department and corrections officers basically handle cases that are outside of the city of Ithaca. Maybe somebody can give a better explanation of this than I can, but it's you'd have to go separately to the city of Ithaca for training and questions about their jail and their staff and their police force. Them to us.
So because I'm confused here, are you saying that the police force in Ithaca does not use the Tompkins County Jail?
No, they do. Yeah, they do. But so would somebody want to explain?
Yes, they do.
The overlap?
They do. You have two separate and distinct police forces in one jail.
Joanne, can you?
You're not using a microphone.
It's hard, yeah.
I said if we are talking about public safety here and the capacity in the jail and what's driving it, why isn't the Ithaca Police Department represented here today? I find that astonishing. And the other thing is I am a taxpayer. I like to pay my taxes. I would like my taxes to go towards more things like OAR, the Department of Probation, and things to keep people from getting arrested to begin with. Please consider those things in the future. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Natalie?
Brian, may I say something real quickly to Joanne?
Sure.
Joanne, I want to say real quickly, we can't speak for the police department, but in response to my friend Gino, I think that's why Brian was saying earlier in the public meeting, I would want to bring the police chief with me because that's where they should be able to answer some of those general questions about their participation in arrest and some of the things that you had as well. You know, not, you know, trying to pass it off, but saying the police should be there. We can't speak for why they're not here, but, you know, the public meeting definitely is what Brian was saying. The chiefs, because it's not just one chief of police in our area. I mean, we have a chief of police in Keoga Heights, we have chiefs in Trumansburg, you know, so to make sure that people are there as well.
Natalie, I'm not going to try your last name.
Nesva Durrani from Ithaca. I just wanted to say a big
thank you to everyone from the community who came out here today, in spite of work, schedules, other commitments, for this public presentation, inconveniently scheduled for 3:30 p.m. Brian?
Yes.
I think that you and I are looking at the same list of questions, the one you referred to a bit earlier. It's listed 1 through 8. Do you have that in front of you?
I've got a few of them. Got 1 through 21.
Here's 1 through 8.
Okay, go ahead.
Do you see it? It's the list submitted by Chantal.
Yep.
You covered a few questions on this list that were sort of broadly addressed in the meeting. Could you address number 8 now, please? Read it and answer.
Please read number 8, and so it's not a mystery to everyone.
I will. And I saw this one earlier. Finally, does a member of the Public Safety Committee have a conflict of interest in considering and approving this budget expansion? If so, has the conflict been formally disclosed to the public?
Could you address it, please?
What does that mean?
Yeah.
Could you explain what the conflict is?
Yeah.
Make it easier to answer.
I mean, it's just simply asking whether, as far as you know, is there any conflict of interest? Just, it's a simple question.
No.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
Hey, Brian, I want to ask you a question.
He's out of order. He's out of order.
Would you be paid overtime for that?
No.
Jamie Hendricks.
I have two somewhat unrelated questions. The first question concerns the bond, authorization of bond to finance the project by full legislator. What we were wondering was whether that is going to be a voter-approved bond or whether that is not the case.
It's the latter. It's not the case. So there are some governments and schools that require voter approval for bonds. The county does not require that. It does require a two-thirds majority,
okay,
a supermajority to pass a bond resolution.
Yeah. Then I would like to repeat Joanne's question because I didn't think we get a clear answer. Why is it that the city of Ithaca police chief is not here today?
I can answer that, I believe. Yeah. To be honest with you, I don't see where the Ithaca city police chief would be here to answer questions about the jail expansion, and that's what this meeting really was about and what we're doing. Do they put people in our correction facility? Yes, they do. But to be honest with you, in fairness to the chief, I see no reason that they would be here. They weren't invited, okay? And I know that I wouldn't show up at the city meeting unless I was invited, and they weren't invited here. I think that's the simplest answer.
They were not invited.
They were not.
Yeah. I see Jim Dennis has his hand up.
Yeah, go ahead, Jim.
One comment, something I learned earlier and actually knew before I came in here. Police don't put people in jail. Judges do. And, you know, everyone has to hear that.
Yes. Sorry.
Go ahead.
I wanted to just...
Go ahead. Martha, why don't you come up to the table? Just come on up to the table.
Brian, could you, or maybe the sheriff, explain how many different law enforcement agencies there are in the county?
Well, you've got the city, you've got every village has a police department, and you have the state police, you have the New York State Park Police, and you also have the conservation officer, DEC. started by the inner. So those are all the agencies here in this county. So.
And two campuses.
And two campuses. Yeah, excuse me. Yeah, how could I forget them? The universities. Well, three campuses because TC3 also. Yeah,
and all of those agencies can arrest people and put them in front of a judge, right?
That's correct.
So we could have had all the agencies represented here and only spent all of our time talking about arrests, but as you pointed out, this was about the renovation of the jail. And I think people have to understand that if there's a problem with the Ithaca police that's separate and distinct from the sheriff's department, the data about arrests includes all of those agencies, right?
Right.
So that's how anybody gets in front of a judge in Tompkins County.
Right. Yep. Yes. Carol Chok, yeah.
Yeah. So I think that these questions about how these various police forces operate and why would the county would assume that if people came to us to engage us in dialogue that we would expect that we would be the ones to engage in the dialogue sort of point to the need for a longer, more extended dialogue between us. I think there's a lot of information on both sides here that we spend a lot of time understanding all this. I mean, I've been here 6 years. I was on the Public Safety Committee my first couple of years, I think, which happened to coincide with the whole review of the CJATI programs. So I spent all year learning about these, and then I think that there's a whole body of literature and thought about the ways in which there's systematized problems in the country, in the state, in the world, and they're all useful, but it's the kinds of answers and the kinds of ways that we sort of are like two ships passing in the night about some of the questions and the answers speak to, I think, the need for something a little more extended. But it also, you have to understand our process, which, you know, the reason it came to this committee is this is the regular meeting time of this committee, and it's the appropriate place to have started the discussion. If we're going to, you know, engage in something more extended or in the community, that's something additional you set up. And I think, so I don't know how to get there, but I am feeling the need to have, I don't know, it understood on both sides that to get to a place where you would understand, in order to be able to present alternatives that might work within our system that's already set up that could expand the approach that we're taking and respond to the kinds of questions you're raising, which are great questions, there has to be this movement on both sides to understand how our system is already set up so that we can then, you know, there's, for example, all of those agencies that Martha just was pointing out exist, there is a place that they meet that just hasn't even been mentioned yet, which is the, one place that representatives from all those forces come together is on the ECROC committee. So there are there are many venues, and it would take a lot of work to the emergency communications.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. So.
We'll get with you. Get with you on that.
Did you? I still have two questions and a very quick comment. Just respectfully disagree with Sheriff Lansing about whether or not the chief of police needed to be invited to this meeting. There's a special entry of the City of Ithaca website where it logs all the arrests that have been made. And I didn't keep track of every day how many people get arrested, but I saw 40 arrests within a month's time and all the reasons they were arrested. So I think it's really important because we all know that the police officer has some discretion about whether or not he arrests a person. Like, I've been stopped when my license was suspended. They didn't arrest me, but I see several people that got arrested. And by the way, that was in Broome County. That was not in Tompkins County that this happened. Now, this for future dialogue. I really hope that the city, the chief of police, is part of this. Now, my last question was when you show the slides that show that Tompkins County was in 52nd or 51st position, did it occur to you to kind of say, gee, we want to be at the bottom, we want to be the lowest county, so what can we do to reduce the supply of inmates to the jail population? Because we all know we can expand the jail, but if the supply goes up, then we still need to board out people. So we really need to think about reducing the supply. And and that's a question for each and every one of you. Have you met with your partners in the other counties, or has this thought occurred to you during the last month? And that's also in response to what Paula Ioannidis said, is that the state is pushing all these mandates on the counties, closing prison jails and wanting you to take care of the problem with your local jails. So as each and every one of you started thinking about, we need to get together with our other counties and kind of formulate a strategy to push back to the state and say, hey, you cannot keep on doing this, sending unfunded mandates in our direction. Thank you.
Thank you. Claire? Grady? Yes.
Actually, I was hoping each one of you would respond to this question, whether you have been thinking about this and what your plans are in the next 2 months.
Yeah, Martha?
We do participate in the New York State Association of Counties with every other county in the state, and most of what we talk about is unfunded mandates. And in fact, the ship has mostly left the train has left the station on jail expansions, I believe, in other counties where under Tim Joseph's leadership, we did push back, and we were the only county that did, and the rest of them kind of sat around like, oh my gosh, you said what to the state? And in the meantime, they were building their jails and spending hundreds of millions of dollars and incarcerating many more people. So I believe, and maybe Ken, you can correct me, or maybe Joe, about how many jails have been either built or are in the process since we started this, since we pushed back 10 years ago. So it's kind of late. If they've already built a big new jail, they're not going to unbuild it. So I think we have been involved with other counties, and really Tim was I was at several sessions where Tim was kind of leading the conversation to say, you really don't have to do this, but the rest of them did. Am I right?
Yeah, no. Tioga County built a new jail. Broome County has built on to theirs, and I just talked to Sheriff Harder about a month ago. They're going to be adding more. Chemung, they've enlarged their jail. I know Cortland's taken a stance, but I don't know so much they're taking a stance just only because of financial reasons, I'm sure. But they're overcrowded big time. So, but there, yeah, a lot of other counties have expanded their jails or built new ones. So you're correct.
Claire. Thanks. Claire?
Oh, dear. Oh, hi.
Hi.
I've come twice before, and each time I begin my remarks by thanking those of you who have been in this struggle for a long time. And John Rowley is now here today, and thanks to you, John. But if I haven't said it also very clearly, to thanks to my fellow community members who are not paid, and I want to thank you, Gino, as you walk out the door, for doing that every day in and day out and night work of being a community member who literally saves lives. And I want to acknowledge people. I just think of my neighbor Sharon, who I just left on Elm Street, and all that she does, unpaid work, to keep
build the fabric of the neighborhood and the community, and I believe literally saves lives and keeps people out of harm's way and out of jail. I think it's really important to acknowledge how grateful to meet some of you here and to know more of the details of what you do, and to know, imagine that all of that stuff is like you're talking with human beings every day, and this is hard. And yes, it makes me tremble because it's real, it's some of the hardest stuff. But what we have here is this community of incredibly creative, intelligent, heartfelt, lived people who are adding to this collective wisdom. So yes, let's open to it and not contract to it, but open to it and be grateful. And I just want to thank you all who've led this movement to resist mass incarceration, which Paula points out is a trend. It's not, I mean, it's like those figures bear out. This is not somebody's just feeling or opinion here. We incarcerate more people. Now, you've heard all of that before. Those statistics maybe are worth repeating every time and not as a question to you in this session. But on a very practical, little tiny little question point, I want to know, can we see the blueprints for this expansion? I would like that to, I'd like to see that blueprint. I would also, I'm particularly interested in this outdoor rec area, having spent time in federal and county prison, federal prison and county jails. It sounds really humanitarian, and yet when you don't get sunshine for days and weeks and months and sometimes years, you've been denied a human right. That's my feeling. And those really slick-looking things, I don't know what it looks like. I would really like to know what it looks like.
Two things. Is that on the website?
It is, although it's in a committee. It would be, you'd have to dig for it to find a committee. We've put the PowerPoint online, easy to access. What we can do is we can bring the plans for the jail, the renovation, into the same place. So you'll be able to see it on our webpage.
Okay.
But in terms of sunshine?
Online?
I think we had a presentation at the legislature meeting, and that would be online if we could find the date.
It is, although, again, you'd have to dig for it. I'd like to make it as accessible as we can. It's that presentation.
There you go.
Thank you.
And, Claire, just to answer your other point. It's a three-sided, covered outdoor facility, but there's other space outside it where you can get sunshine.
Okay.
Yeah. Great. And you can stay under it out of the rain.
Okay. So,
yeah.
Great. So earlier, I think it was Joanne, thank you, sorry, that asked the question of Mr. Moriani about the use, oh no, maybe it was Paula, that could you take those capital fund, the bonds, and apply them to OAR? And you answered correctly that no, they don't translate. And yet it was explained to me that the 10% that would be needed, or in this case 20%, I guess, no wait, 50%, every year you would have to be paying back that bond. You have to have the cash on the budget to be paying back that bond. So that percentage is available to put to OAR. Right? Wouldn't that be...
So you're saying if we didn't borrow the money, that means that there would be $65,000 a year of debt service that wouldn't be incurred. You wouldn't spend it.
Right.
So that would, you're saying that would give the,
would
the capacity
available.
To do
right.
Right. And the only thing that I would say in response, understanding your point, is that we believe that by investing this money in the jail, there can be savings that will offset at least some of that, and we think probably all of that cost. So if you didn't do this renovation of the jail, there are really lost savings there. So, again, I just want you to understand that there are two parts of it. One is new cost, but there also is an opportunity to save money that's currently going to other counties to board our inmates.
maybe.
Go ahead.
Could I just make one quick comment? OAR is supporting the addition of the 7 beds, and we're doing it on a humanitarian basis. We have 90-some people in custody, 8 of whom at least are out of our county. We're a really little agency. We can't get to those people. We can't get them attorneys quickly. We can't get their families there to visit. Their families can't make phone calls. I believe in the macro big picture that you build it, they will come. I understand that. I understand the over-incarceration of Americans and all that, but I also understand that those people, largely women and juveniles, are people who we can't assist, and that's unconscionable for us.
So I just have one last remark. Thank you. And that just is a personal commitment. The bigger picture is really important for me because we are here as the Public Safety Committee, and we've all talking also about human rights and that this is a human rights issue. And in that same vein, and I've said it before, but it's, again, a personal commitment to always bring in this picture of what is public safety, what is human rights, and what is real crime is my big constant question. And I would suggest that what is not bigger than us, but part of our question, is what we spend as a nation our money on. Economies of death. This is a little graph that the Quakers make. I'm trusting that it's accurate. And it shows a nation that spends 60% of our money, the people's money, on military, an economy of death. And that isn't even including the prisons. Okay, so that's why we don't have money. That the people who will fill, the 2.3 million people who fill our prisons and jails, are what I would like to say on the receiving end of crime. And that's not to diminish, because I live on Elm Street, I have neighbors, I have people that suffer with all of the ravages of poverty and racism and the other things that have been put before us. So I'm not diminishing that. But I truly believe on a spiritual level, if we who are so privileged not to have some of those things and we're not targeted and being put in jail ourselves, that if we took held accountable this big crime, we wouldn't have to be patronizingly helping those who are this victim.
I think there's a strong corollary between that. And I'm not saying that this is just a conversation in this room, but it is a personal commitment for me not to talk about it without also...
Okay.
That's the fuller picture.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah.
I understand with back and forth, the 3-minute time limit has kind of gone out the window, but some of us have to leave, we could try to limit some of this. I have questions I've been waiting for.
You were reading my mind. I have 4 from the public. If we could do these quickly, if you've got a question to ask, please ask it. We'll get it answered. I know there's a couple of legislators that have been sitting here listening to the dialogue. They want to do what legislators do, and that is to comment, and rightfully so. And hopefully we can wrap this up within a half an hour. And I'll preface that by this obviously is not the last conversation that we're going to have. It's a continuing dialogue. It should be a continuing dialogue. So, Neil, Uli?
Hi, my name is Neil. I live in the city of Ithaca. To me, a lot of what we're talking about comes back to basic logic, and I'd like you guys to reconsider the logic of this. And I'll give you one example of something that was said here today. The question was, where is the city of Ithaca's chief of police? And someone said, well, it's not the police that put people in jail, it's the judges. Okay, that may very well be true. But as a simple question of logic, how do people get before the judge before they get put into jail? Let's look at the logic. Let's go back to the beginning. Not just the state pushing this mandate on us, but what else could be done? And let's look at the big picture and look at how it's being done in other places, not just in this country, but in other countries as well. Thank you.
Thanks, Neil. Chantel Thomas.
Thanks. My name is Chantel, and I live here in Ithaca. And since the hour is late, I'm not going to mention some of the points that that I had wanted to, especially because both Mr. Robeson and some of the others on the legislature have said that this is just the beginning of a continued dialogue, and that's great to hear. So hopefully there'll be more time to discuss the substantive points. So I had submitted the list of 8 questions to you, and some of the questions were answered, some weren't. I won't ask the substantive ones at the moment, just focusing on process. One question would be, will the next episode in this dialogue be held at an hour when working people in the community can attend? So in other words, after 5 p.m. or after 6 p.m.? And when will we know when that next session is scheduled? That's one question. And the second question is just the first one that was on the list that I submitted, which is the Public Safety Committee prepared to conduct a study of the reasons for incarceration and whether alternatives to incarceration have been pursued to their fullest extent? And Mr. Robeson, you had answered, I think, in part by saying that members of the legislature, the committee, and the agencies who are here study the matter on an ongoing basis. That's a bit of a different point because it's sort of a noun versus verb distinction. So it may well be, and I'm sure that you all do study the matter on an ongoing basis and are committed to it in many ways. Conducting a study is making a series of findings that are publicly available and published in the form of a document that can be subjected to scrutiny. And my understanding is that studies have been conducted in the past. So Mr. Mariani had said that there was a 2002 study and several other studies, but that the last one was towards the end of the last decade, so that's 3 or 4 years ago. And so it seems that a precedent has been established of best practice, which is to conduct a study before further steps are taken. And that would be a good thing to do in this case. So the question was, is the committee and the legislature prepared to conduct a study and issue a study on this matter?
Well, I think your first question was regarding meetings. And go ahead, stay up there. Regarding meetings and when the meetings occur and things of that nature. As I said earlier, we're about to get into a season where everybody's going to be taking a pretty needed break, I think. Mm-hmm. And we're going to regroup, and we may literally regroup. And it will be under the purview of the next Public Safety Committee meeting where the steps go from there. With regards to the time for this meeting, these meetings are set virtually. These meetings were set in January and, mm-hmm. and publicized. They happen once a month, more often if necessary. Quite frankly, they're for the convenience of the staff, and it's to conduct. You didn't see much of it tonight, but most times there's a normal county business that takes place, And this is extraordinary for anybody that's been to a public safety committee meeting. But nonetheless, it will be the responsibility of that committee, yeah, that chair.
And so the idea is, so the suggestion that has been raised has been to actually go outside of the established schedule and enter into an intentional and focused dialogue with the community on the jail expansion. So these would have to be, I think, specially scheduled meetings, and hopefully there's a commitment to make those meetings at a time that people who work during the day can attend them.
I guess I'm saying that could happen, but it would be the commitment of an unknown group at this point.
So you can't take responsibility for making a commitment to that issue?
I can't name myself to the committee. Martha?
Yeah, I think the public needs to really understand. One of the things that happens at a committee meeting is that the committee members discuss with each other, and that has not been able to happen. So, you know, Brian cannot, he could make a commitment, but he'd probably be lying. I don't think we want him to do that. Nobody knows what the committees will be a month from now or even 3 weeks from now. So that's an anomaly. We happen to be in December. So I think there will be plenty of time for the new committee to absorb this information. I will point out that Will Burbank in the back is also a legislator. And I'm also not on this committee. Carol's not on this committee. So right. Three of us are here who are other than the Public Safety Committee for 2013.
Yeah.
It's late. The process is going to continue. Nobody here can make a commitment to you except that I think there's certainly a will that we will continue discussing
right.
all this with
the public.
I would
just say I think that's fair enough, and you all are smart and talented people, so I'm sure that you can overcome the barriers of procedure and focus on, I think, the outcome that has been recognized as being important, which is to somehow create a forum for people to attend after the end of the working day, and I won't belabor that point further, but thank you for the response. And then just the second point on issuing a study that would make findings and conclusions on the basis for incarceration of the current jail population.
Susie, what was the study you did in 2007? I think was the last one.
The strategic action plan where we looked at the entry points into the system. And out of that came some of the reentry work for people coming out back in, assessments in the jail, innovative things that many of the other counties are not doing. And it was very productive. It was done very systemically. The other thing that we, you know, had periodically looked at are scientifically proven programs that work. And what we found were things like multi-systemic therapy, MST. We were already doing it.
Yeah.
So, but if members of the public have information internationally or, you know, other state-wise programs that work, feel free to bring them to us. We are always looking.
Yeah.
We are always looking for things that work.
And just one final thought on that is that I think that the point here is that it's important to conduct these studies on a regular basis. So if the last one was issued 6 years ago, it's not to say that everyone here isn't doing their level best to do, you know, to achieve all of the goals that we've agreed are important, but that a regular period of self-assessment may be necessary. And also, just as a matter of procedure, before a decision is taken of this magnitude that the community cares about this much, that a document should be issued explaining the basis for that decision. That would be my opinion about best practices and also practices that this legislature has followed in the past. So I would hope to see that. And
okay.
I will leave the floor.
Point,
thank you.
Point taken. Gwen, you had something?
Yeah, I wanted to, first of all, thank everybody for their input today. And I'm thinking about the comments of Claire. Hi, Claire, wherever you are out there. And Chantel, that's you, right? And Dr. Nagel, is it? I've undertaken a study regarding paradigm shift, theories of punishment, and underlying issues that drive incarceration in our country. Certainly, these are issues that are kind of meta to some of the stuff we're talking about today, but they're important nonetheless. I'm currently working on a project regarding the DWI laws in this country, taking into account different philosophies of prosecution and punishment, as well as international law and different cultural contexts for dealing with this behavior. Some of the things we've talked about tonight touch on exactly this, and those three people that I mentioned are the ones whose comments resonated with me in a way that I think would be a good starting point for some more discussions. I'm not on the legislature, but I am in a position to think seriously about our approaches to crime in this county. So if any of you are interested in talking to me, and I have no power to increase or decrease the number of beds in the jail, I would be interested in having those conversations. And in closing, I'll say I won't meet with you for 3 hours late at, in the evening, but I will meet with you for 3 hours really early in the morning. that's enough for now. Thank you.
Can I just say, this has all been, in my eyes, really good stuff. This was supposed to be a discussion, and I think it has been a discussion. However, the folks that you – hang on, Joanna, I'll get to you in a second. The folks that you've been talking to haven't had a chance to respond, and I mean legislators. So I'm going to give an opportunity, whether you're on the committee or not, for just a quick couple of minutes on what you've heard and any thoughts that you might have. Go ahead, Martha.
I have some factual questions, and I maybe can go quickly through them.
Yep.
There's a really, really important distinction between sentenced and unsentenced and pre-trial and post-trial. You've got my page is 21, the average length of stay of unsentenced. The average length of stay of unsentenced individuals, and then there's the graph of length of stay. That includes, and maybe this is a Gwen question or a Judge Rowley question, that includes people who have been before their trial and before a plea is agreed to.
That's unsentenced.
That's unsentenced. But unsentenced also includes, am I right, people who have been convicted or agreed to a plea before the sentence happens.
That's correct.
So what's the average length of time between that decision of guilt, which a plea is a decision of guilt, so it's a conviction, and sentencing?
Theoretically, for incarcerated inmates, the PSIs are expedited. It used to be 4 weeks. Is that still right, Pat? All right. So 4 weeks for an incarcerated person's PSI, meaning somebody who's sitting in jail, unsentenced.
What's a PSI?
Oh, sorry. Pre-sentence investigation. Pretty in-depth look at factors that the judge would consider for sentencing.
But they've been determined guilty.
Yes.
So this question of are you incarcerated before you're innocent till proven guilty, at that point, there's a determination of guilt.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So in these data on unsentenced individuals, is there any way to know how much of this is before guilt and how much is after guilt?
We have not been able to parse that out yet. We'll continue to work on that. We did throw a footnote, though, on that one slide to note the fact that the population that we're talking about includes those who have been convicted and are awaited sentencing, a process that can take 4 to 6 weeks. So we tried to get that in a footnote, so that's recognized.
And that time while the sentencing is being discussed is part of their
All the time they spend in jail is credited against any sentence of incarceration that they receive.
All right. So anybody who's looking at that needs to understand those, that's a mixed number.
Yeah, if bail is set, that event triggers the crediting of every bit of time against an eventual sentence.
Okay, thank you. How many days, if somebody is, and these alternatives to incarceration programs are all voluntary, correct? That somebody has to, the inmate has to want to participate. If some, let's say there's a judgment of rehab, that somebody should go to rehab, do we know how many days somebody might spend in our jail waiting for a rehab bed? I know it fluctuates, but...
No, we've got that data. Dina Bodner has calculated that as part of Casey Monahan's work. And actually, I was complaining at one point that it seemed like it was taking longer, but the numbers are pretty much about the same. I think it was like 23 days or something, but that data is available. It is actually a remarkable process because we're talking about a lot of pieces, a lot of moving pieces, because there has to be a prosecutor, defense attorney, defendant, and judge who are all on the same page with that. There has to be the evaluation that's done if a person is incarcerated at the jail. Then there has to be the Medicaid public assistance piece, which OAR is a big part of, and the coordination of all of that. And then ultimately, when there's a door-to-door, which happens almost every day from the jail, where people are sent from the jail to treatment, the sheriff's staff actually do that work. So it's quite a complicated process. It works very, very well. I mean, all of these points could be increased, you know, marginally with more money, but this is how it's allocated at this point. But that system does work quite well.
So some of the time somebody spends in jail maybe waiting for that process to go through and waiting to move to rehab.
Yeah, but no question. But it's also not necessarily time wasted. It might be their second or third time going to rehab. So we say, look, you can be sentenced out at any point. You're going to go to prison. And they say, no, I want another chance at it. I say, well, it's going to take a long time to get to St. Joe's Saranac Lake because that's the best treatment facility in the state, and that's the one you need. And there's a waiting list. I say, I'll wait. And, in fact, the time at the jail, well, there's AA meetings, there's NA meetings up there, there's an opportunity for them to at least do some reflecting. Sometimes it's straight-out detoxing. And people do better when they go into rehab clean than when they walk in off the streets still using.
Thank you, Judge. On the construction estimate of 900,000, maybe this is a joke question, how much is for the beds, the renovation of that room, and how much is for the outdoor facility? Or maybe
Rellis here, I think the costs are concentrated on the outdoor facility.
Rellis,
I don't know, two-thirds, one-third maybe?
Yes.
Outside, inside, two-thirds, outside, one-third, inside?
So about 300,000 for the inside renovation, about 600,000 for the recreation area.
Order of magnitude, yeah.
Okay. There's a big question here, and Deb said it a minute ago, and I think this is kind of at the foundation of all of this, the idea that if we build the beds, the system will fill them. I certainly believe that when it comes to, you know, the kind of jail that we rejected of 134, 196, there are a lot of different numbers passed around that we rejected some years ago. I'm not sure that's relevant when you're talking about 7 out of, you know, this 90 beds or 73-bed facility. But I guess I would ask especially Judge Rowley to talk about that. Because the idea, the theory is that if you have a big empty jail, you know, all along the system, people will make decisions that say, well, you got room in the jail, just put them in the jail. Judge, do you have a sense that happens here, either, you know, as a general matter? Do you think judges, magistrates pay attention to jail population when they make those decisions?
100% not. I mean, the last thing I'm going to do is call the jail to see if they got room for them. Those are so separate that it's inappropriate. I said this once at a hearing about the jail where I said, they said, well, you know, you got to take into account taxpayers and stuff. If you send someone up there and they're full, it's going to be a board out. But that can't be part of the decision-making process. I'm looking at the variety of things that I have to do with the bail factors that the district attorney talked about, the options that we have, this person's history. I mean, day reporting is an incredibly valuable resource. If I can send someone a day reporting, I will do that. If it's a day reporting with electronic monitoring, we'll do that. Whatever the variety of choices we have, but it's also if it's a case of violence where there's where the likely outcome is going to be state prison sentence, those cases are more likely to see more substantial bail. But I have no idea on a daily basis what the jail population is and have no interest in it.
All right, thank you. And I just would want to make two other comments. One is that I think it is the point that it's been a while since we really did a comprehensive study is fair and appropriate, and I think we have a really top-notch system, but it could probably, you know, maybe it can be better. I think it's everybody here is committed, all the professionals in our system are committed to doing the best we possibly can. I think it's a good time to do a reality check, and is there anything more that we could do? So I hope that we can pursue that in the coming year as a legislature. As chair of the legislature, I'm not actually on any committees. I won't be chair of the legislature next year. I will ask volunteer to be on this committee. I hope that I will be part of it, part of the discussion. To members of the public, and thank you all for bringing these issues to us. I really, really urge you to go to sit in some of these 20 town and village courts. We've heard you. Go listen to the other folks. Go talk to them. Go to Albany. Go talk to the Public Safety Committee of the New York State Association of Counties. Go talk to your legislators. You've raised issues here. We're going to pursue them. We're going to work even harder than we already do to make this as good a system as we can, as fair and just a system and humane. But the low-hanging fruit is other places. I really urge you to get involved with other counties and hope you'll do that.
Peter Stein.
Yeah, I just I had a bunch of comments to make, but I'll just make one so the other people have time. The question of the scheduling of this meeting and with the notion that is there a problem, do we really want to meet with the people that we represent? And I'd like to give you my own point of view on that. We schedule, excuse me, we schedule lots of meetings in the evening. Every time there's a construction project for a road, we bring out we go to those and meet the public and talk about it. During budget time, we have a lot of meetings in the evening where people can come in. And I think that we are, for myself, I can say that I don't have enough contact with my constituents. It's not a question. I would really welcome more. And as far as I meant to respond to Gino, he invites me to come down and talk to Southside House or anyone else about what I know about Public Safety Committee. I'm certainly will be willing to do that, and I'm sure that any of my colleagues would as well. I don't really think there's a problem there. And if we think we want some kind of a discussion like that, or if some of you think we want some kind of a discussion, you should approach either the chair of the legislature or the chair of the Public Safety Committee or whatever is appropriate, and I'm sure that we will come out and meet and talk with you about it. Basically, that's what I wanted to say.
Jim?
I just want to say thank you to all the members of the staff, the judge, the DA, the sheriff, who came out here and talked to us. I think what the public has to recognize is that we have this in our budget as a capital project with no dollars affixed to it. And we have 5 months or 6 months to look at it and decide what it's finally going to look at or what it's finally going to look like or not look like, as a matter of fact. If we're not done with this, and the talk will continue, and clearly every elected official here will want to take part in that because it has an effect on taxpayers all over the county. And that's why we're all here.
Pam?
Well, I guess I wanted to say that from my perspective, the issue that we are looking at, to me, I guess my focus and the thing that I really see as the problem is the number of people that we have in the jail. And that just sort of looking at some of the figures and some of the bail, the levels that are set for what I would consider minor charges. Now, I am certainly not an expert at this, but this is just my initial looking at this, is that there seems to be, there perhaps are ways that we can reduce further the number of people that we have in our jails. And frankly, if we were to reduce the number of people in our jails by a third, I would still want this renovation, because that recreation space outside is something that will benefit the inmates there. The room, whether it's used for beds or whether it's used for a place, a meeting place for people to do coursework, to meet with their lawyers, there's a lack of space in that jail for people to live. And so I would still be in favor of this project under those circumstances. But I think that the point where we need to work here is to look at the high bails. And why is that happening to violations and misdemeanors? There are other ways that we can reduce the number of people who are sitting there waiting trial.
Carol.
I'll add my thanks to everybody, staff as well as the visitors who have come. Joe, I sent you an email a little while ago asking if we could have some information just to start off the big picture of our study. Looking back over the last 10 years, dollars spent per year on our ATI programs. We went through a crunch after 2008. Everything contracted then. So let's look at total, how those have gone down or bounced back or not. Secondary, you can look at direct ATI programs, but you also then would have to do some kind of thinking, which is harder to do in numbers, about programs that affect the numbers in our jail, a homeless program, food security. If you broaden that net, how have our human services and community support programs in general fared over the last 10 years compared to what we're spending on the jail and public safety? Where's that balance and how has it changed? Would be interesting to know. In addition to other things that might come out of further discussion.
Thanks. Can I ask, is Paul Berry or James Hicks, I think? Ricks?
Just in time. I was listening. There were a few things that I found upsetting. Before I even got here, Gino had told me about requesting, I think for you, sir, I don't know your name, but you seem to be running things, to come to the south side.
Trying.
And you said to, well, when you said, yeah, if I bring the police chief, I took that as a racial slur, or that you felt like you had to be protected when you came to the south side. I heard you explain it in a pretty politically correct way. Just now, that the police are the ones that make the arrest, and so that he should be there to explain it. Then I heard somebody else say that the police, aren't the ones responsible for the people that are going to jail. It almost feels like a game of three-card Molly going on here. Who's responsible? Is it the judge? Is it the police? And if you listen to some of the tapes, like from Stop and Frisk, they had a court judgment against Stop and Frisk because it was racist. And if you heard some of the police speak about some of these children, as they approached them, they had like tape, they were tape recorded, you know, and they were talking about these kids like they were in an occupied country, that they had to demonstrate who was in authority around here. One officer was saying, like, why are we going to bother these kids? So we got to show them who's in charge here. And I think when they bring those kind of kids in, if they, like, say, well, what the hell are you doing? When they get in front of the judge, they're going to jail. One officer was saying they're not doing anything. Other one that said that was saying that was brought before his commander, and the commander told him to get with the program. So I'm saying, well, that was in New York. Okay? And I mean, everybody sounds here sounds so caring and considerate, you know, but it seems like we're talking about dealing with the effect of a really racist, jacked up system and some pretty rough police that kind of enforce it instead of the cause. And I think that's what we're trying to get to, you know, the cause. Dealing with people is no matter how humane it is after they've been through an egregious a social disparity, economic disparity, educational disparity, and to talk about how to house them humanely is a troubling concept for me to deal with. I kind of would want to get to how are they in this position in the first place. I think that's kind of more important. I heard some gentleman say that he had to put some lady in jail that was pregnant to help her. I guess she's a drug addict and maybe she'll go out and hurt herself. You know, I can see at that point, yeah, well, maybe we need to do something, but what the hell happened before she even got to that point is what I'm wondering, that you have to say, do I have to put this woman in jail to help her save her baby? You know, somehow I think this issue could have been addressed before it got to that point. To incarcerate somebody for their own good is a scary concept. I'm saying, well, what in the hell are you taking them from to put them in jail? What is so bad? You know, how is their life so miserable that jail is an improvement? And I think that's some of the things we need to start addressing also. I was in the Sean Greenberg group. I am in the Sean Greenberg group. We had a workshop. We had a young black girl, right? She lived in a black neighborhood. She said, she didn't see that much crime and whatnot, regular police and whatnot, but the family did well, and they moved to an integrated neighborhood, you know, upward mobility. She said, man, it was more underage drinking and house parties with drugs all over the place, but nobody ever got arrested. You know, and I'm addressing somebody, I think it was you again, sir, that said that you go to the area where most arrests take place. That area is where people are most policed. You put a lot of police watching people every day, you're going to get a lot of arrests. And who knows for what? Can depend on the policeman's attitude that day or any other number of relative things. Okay, so I definitely wanted to say that some of the language that's being employed here, you know, like the area where most people are arrested, okay, that's code for the black neighborhood or where poor neighborhood, you know, that's the area where people are most policed. And I think that those things need to be addressed too. Okay? Gotta go.
Thank you.
That wasn't a question.
Yep. Thank you. Will, I saw you hop up to the table.
Thank you, Brian. This young woman, do you want to speak? Or?
Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. So I'm Will Burbank. I'm not on the committee, but I have really appreciated the thoughtful discussion and presentation, both from all of our staff people and agency people, but also from the audience. I am heartened that we live in a community where we ask this kind of question. I can guarantee you that in communities all over this country, this question is not being asked. Typically, the question is, we have a crime problem. Why don't we just put them all away? I think we are, you know, it's very good that we're doing this. I hope that, and I've heard a lot of very, very thoughtful, intelligent comments from the folks, the public that are asking these, that are challenging us to consider an alternative to this jail renovation. I do hope that you have heard back some of the complexity of what we're dealing with. that many of the factors are completely beyond our control. And we are trying to make a smart decision that is genuinely not only economically smart, but humane. And this discussion will continue in the coming months. I've been impressed by the fact that people have come and come back again. That takes a lot of effort. I hope you will continue to engage. But also, if you see areas where we can genuinely do things to address just the forces that are sending people into jail that we have control over, by all means, speak with us. And please recognize that many of those decisions are made by other bodies and put pressure elsewhere. Thank you.
Thanks. Yeah. Go ahead, young lady. Just please state your name when you get up there, please.
I'm really nervous. So my name is Carolina, and I'm here today because the day I found out about the jail expansion, I also saw an article in the paper that said, "Where will our mentally ill go?" And this is what concerns me as someone who has been faced with arrest because I wouldn't comply to going into an ambulance. I am here to speak up and represent the mentally ill community. Elmira Psychiatric is closing now, and I can't help but feel like there's a correlation between jail expansion and the poor, horrible state of our mental health system. And I'm actually going back to college for psychology and politics, and I want to work on these issues in the future. But it's just, I guess my question is, I personally do not feel safe right now. I know this is the Safety Council, and I feel like I'm an intelligent person and I have merit in the community, but how many people are there in the jail system that are mentally ill and are not getting the help that they need? Green Street, there are so many failed mental health programs in this community. Meanwhile, there are ones that could be successful if they had the funding, such as this little private peer-run group called SPACE, who is completely lacking funding, and I'm actually going to be helping them this year with fundraising. So as an intern for school, and it's just like, what are we doing? You know, and there's been so many successful therapeutic, like, programs we've been talking about the jail, and we have mentioned almost nothing about prevention. And we have mentioned, and there's other situations where I've been in where it's just been atrocious, which I don't want to mention in this 3 minutes. But, yeah, so I'm here. I guess I want to state my personal story because I'm here because I'm gaining awareness about what's going on the other side because I feel like things aren't being done. So basically I'm wondering about prevention and okay. Also, if within the jails, if there are, like, what is happening to the people who do need psychiatric help, because we've mentioned all these programs, but isn't that the main staple, rehabilitation? Aren't we trying to rehabilitate these people and integrate them back into society? Like,
okay. I'm sorry. What's your last name?
Carolina Grunberg.
Okay.
Yeah, I can...
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah. Who wants to take a quick stab at that one? Susie? Judge?
Just real quick. I have conversations with Elmira Psychiatric Center and some other facilities when we deal with our juveniles. And your point is very well taken. And I can tell you that we share that. I can tell you that Elmira Psychiatric Center is not definitively closing. I was told today that they are reevaluating because we need a facility like that in Central New York. And it is proactive concern, very well justified. So it's being restudied. So thank you.
Judge, did you have some?
Well, I can just say that, I mean, there are mental health services provided at the jail on a daily basis. There's a psychiatric staff there, a psychiatrist that's available. People are provided medication there. it's not a particularly good place, to say the least, for a mentally ill person who's actively experiencing symptoms, and it certainly aggravates symptoms. And frankly, that was what I was talking about with the state prison system. I know a number of people who work in staff positions in the state prisons, and the mental illness there is rampant, and the conditions are pretty rough. The less options we have, the less good options. I mean, with the closing of institutions like Elmira Psych, they're trying to say we've got better options. But until we have the better options, they're making things worse by closing institutions like that. And we've been through this routine before in other areas. So I don't think there's a direct connection between our beds and that closing. But if the help is not good, inevitably mentally ill people will cross paths with the police and end up incarcerated. I mean, that's the reality. That does happen.
And I can say that there's all forms of government, not the least of which is the State Association of Counties, that are lobbying very hard so that those facilities do not close. Joanne, did you have something quick?
Yes, very quick.
Okay.
Thank you for letting me speak again. Thank you, the woman who just spoke about that. And Mr. Robeson, you said in your last meeting that you're very aware of there's a lot of people in jail right now in Tompkins County who are suffering with mental illness. In your words, they shouldn't be there, but we have no place else to put them. I'd like to know what really the people here today are doing personally to make sure that those places don't close. And the other thing is, New York State right now, Tompkins County especially, Finger Lakes region, is a destination for people to come from other states on vacation. And other states that surround the state of New York have done away with ridiculous laws for marijuana use, which is actually a very successful treatment for many mental illnesses and for physical illnesses. So for Judge Rowley and maybe D.A. Wilkinson, how do you handle people who come in to New York State from other regions and are arrested for possession of marijuana, and how are they handled here? Do we prosecute them here, put them in jail here, or do you send them back to wherever they came from? And secondly, why is that a good idea, to arrest people in New York, when we know that a few miles down the road, what they're doing is absolutely not considered a crime at all? And in fact, it's considered a treatment.
With respect to the prosecution of people who come into Tompkins County with marijuana who aren't from here, the jurisdiction of the case is here, not where they came from. The jurisdiction for the offense is here. Marijuana crimes in New York have been substantially deregulated. The legislature has not yet seen fit to completely deregulate or even legalize the use of medical marijuana or the use of recreational marijuana, as has been done in other states. While as DA, I have considerable discretion about the way in which I prosecute crimes and other offenses, I am not empowered, nor do I think it would be ethical, to just say I'm going to ignore all of these certain kinds of crimes because I don't think they should be crimes. That's not my mandate. That's not what they pay me for. I will say, and I think that public records bear this out, the prosecution of people who possess or use small amounts of marijuana is very low priority in Tompkins County. It is, for very small amounts of marijuana, it's not a crime. People are entitled to an adjournment in contemplation of dismissal. For the...
Did you say it's not a crime?
It's a violation.
It's a violation. Right. Kick it.
Parents, I just
want to
understand.
Yep.
And let's say my brother... He is 72 years old. He lives in Connecticut. He
yep.
comes to see me.
Yep.
And he may use marijuana for his cancer treatment. So he doesn't want to come to New York to see me until after that is completed, because he's afraid of being arrested in New York State for using a treatment for cancer. Yeah. So I wanted to know how you – do you write him a slip, or do you say, now you're going to have to come back to New York to appear?
Well, the reality is that if he is using marijuana in a residence for therapeutic purposes, his risk of arrest is small, but or non-existent probably. If he was cited for it, he would receive an appearance ticket to appear at a certain time and date in a certain court, and he would have to appear here.
So he would have to come back from Connecticut for a citation for marijuana use?
He would for an unregistered car or for a parking ticket.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I've got two marijuana cases pending. One's 10 pounds and one's 50 pounds. Those are the cases that make it to the felony level.
Mm-hmm. I just want to make sure that we're not, you know, putting people in jail for long periods of time on a violation here, which is not a violation in a few more miles down the road. I think that would be egregious. Thank you.
It's a legislative issue. And
a state legislation.
Right.
I was just going to ask, is that New York State?
Yeah.
So you're off the hook?
A state legislation. Right. These guys absolutely cannot legalize anything.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Unless somebody's got something real pressing, I think we'll go ahead and adjourn. I want to thank everybody for coming out, especially staff here. Hopefully we've answered a lot of questions, and just remember that the discussion is not over. We'll see you in January. Motion to adjourn. 1-2. There you go. Thank you.